Acts 13 is where we left off, and it's where we want to start today. We read last time Acts 13, verses 26 to 30. This is part of Paul's sermon. This is the first recorded sermon by Paul, and he's going through a lot of Jewish history. Let's go back and reread that. We did read it last week and made a couple of preliminary points, but that's where we stopped, so it's a good place to begin again. In Acts 13, 26, he says, Brethren, children of the stock of Abraham, and those among you that fear God, to us is this word of this salvation sent forth. For they that dwell in Jerusalem and the rulers, because they knew him, that's Jesus, they knew him not, nor the voices of the prophets, which are read every Sabbath, fulfilled them by condemning him. And though they found no cause of death in him, yet asked they of Pilate that he should be slain. And when they had fulfilled all these things that were written of him, they took him down from the tree and laid him in a tomb. But God raised him from the dead, and he was seen for many days of them that came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem, who are now his witnesses unto the people. Now, I've mentioned to you before that Paul, in this sermon, you can easily divide it into three different sections. We've already gone through section one, and it's kind of like Stephen back there in Acts chapter 7. He goes through a lot of history. And this is now Paul's third and his final point. The third and final point is going to be starting in verse 38. But this is here, what we just read, 26 to 30. This begins that second point. So as you look back a little bit, he talked about the Messiah was going to come. That was already dealt with in a good way. And now he's going to end with the information as far as how to apply the lesson. But he goes back and recounts a little more history about Jesus. He came into the world and your people, the Jews, wanted him dead. And that's what happens. He's still friendly. As you look at how he addresses things, as you go back to verse 16, he talks about men of Israel. But now as he addresses the crowd in verse 26, how does he address them? He addresses them as brethren. So we're of the same group as far as Jews. And Paul said, I want to have a nice conversation with you. Now, when he goes back and he talks to the people about Abraham, you're having a conversation with somebody, you want to head them in a certain direction, think about a salesperson. What kind of language might the salesperson use to go ahead and encourage you to start thinking along his lines? Namely, I want you to buy the car or the house, whatever it might be. Once had a lady tell me that she sold World Book. And whenever she went up and knocked on somebody's door, she made sure that she looked around the house to find something that she could compliment them on. She found a flower bed that was pretty, or she said, your property is pretty, you live in a nice area, or you sure have a nice decoration on the house, whatever that was. You're trying to reach out to people, and you're trying to establish some kind of bond. And that's what Paul does. He says, we have this bond with the fathers. Who do you think the fathers were? All the way back. Who? All right, specifically probably at least three of them. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So you go back and you say, we've got this point of commonality, remember? And that certainly would have probably, at least for a time, brought forth some good feelings from these people. It didn't go so well after a period of time. And then he says, look, there were some promises made to the fathers. And we'll have a little bit more to say about that when we get down to verse 32. And then he doesn't overlook some people in the assembly. He also talks about the people who feared God. Well, that certainly would have been the Jews, but was there anybody else who feared God? All right, you've got some of the Gentiles. They sometimes would come to the synagogues. Some of them had been proselytes. They would have embraced the Jewish religion at least as much as they could. And Paul says, we want to talk to you about this word. And he says, it's not just a word. He says, it is a word of what? It is a word of... Okay, anything else there? It's a word of salvation. And he says that's been sent forth. Well, that word of salvation sounds a little similar to what Paul wrote in Romans chapter 1 and verse 16. There he said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel or the word of God. He said the gospel is what? He says it is God's power to salvation. So he's still thinking along these times or along these terms, not written in the book of Romans yet, but still he will at a later time, and you see that coming up. So salvation is available to all, but he makes it clear in Acts 13, 26 to 30 that these Jews did not immediately recognize it. He points out really what sounds like firsthand knowledge about what took place in Jerusalem. Now, how Paul had that knowledge, we're not told. I'm kind of inclined to think that when he went over to Arabia for about 3 years, Jesus probably covered some of those things. When he talks to some of the other Christians, maybe some people like Luke, he got some information as far as what happened with Jesus in Jerusalem. We don't know where he was exactly. He was schooled by Gamaliel, so he could have been in Jerusalem when Jesus was put to death. So maybe he was able to see some of what took place. We simply don't know. But Paul did have that information about Christ, and he also knew that these rulers did not see Jesus for who he was. As you look at Acts 13 and verse 27, it says that these people knew him not. Now that seems a little odd, because what else does Paul say? There were these Jews. Once a week, where were they going? They were going to the synagogue. And in the synagogue on that Sabbath day, what were they hearing? All right, they were hearing the word of God. He specifically talks about the law and the prophets. If you were a Jew and you went to the synagogue, you were going to hear readings from the law and the prophets. Now, you might come 3 or 4 times, you might come 20 or 30, or you might come 100 times, but if you're coming over a lifetime, year after year, week after week after week, eventually they're going to get to the stuff that talks about Christ, right? But these guys weren't getting it. Now, how could you sit in the pew, so to speak, week after week, month after month, year after year, and not get it? Jesus shows up, and you've heard all that information about him, and it just, choop, right over the head. How can you miss it?
I think we have a phrase today that probably explains it. They just didn't have a clue. They knew what the word was. They had heard it. They could probably recite it. They just didn't know what it meant.
It just didn't click. We have that with parents and kids, don't we? The parent tries to drill something into the child's mind, and the child hears and hears and hears, but as far as really connecting it. And sometimes it happens with adults. Maybe a husband-wife relationship. The husband says to the wife, or the wife says to the husband, this is a problem, and the spouse just never gets it. So it does happen.
He didn't fit. Jesus didn't fit their idea of what was coming.
Yeah.
He was expecting something totally different, like a king that was going to come in and just take over everything.
Yeah, so they did believe a Messiah was going to come. They were convinced of that. But you're right, trying to put those pieces together was certainly not. So it's almost kind of surprising on the one hand, but as Stan mentioned, we do see that taking place in our time as well. Now here's another practical point. They talk about the voices, or Paul talked about the voices of the prophets. Where were those voices of the prophets? All right, they've been dead for a long time, so it was not like they had any recordings or videos, or the prophets were coming to those synagogues. The voices were from the writings, and the voices of the prophets were heard on a regular basis. Well, as you look at that point, what's the application to today? Do we still have the voice of Christ? We do. Do we have the voice of the apostles? Yeah, and we even have the voice of the prophets, because all that information has been recorded for us. So somebody comes along today and they have some bad things to say about the Bible. They denigrate the Bible. They say, well, all you have is the Bible. It's an old book. It's a dead book. Wait a minute. What's the Bible say about itself? It is the living word. It's active. It's sharper than any two-edged sword. And we still have the voice of God and his people. Now, here's a little point that you may not know. Verse 27, you have that word new. We've talked about this before, but that word which is translated new, remember that we have some words in English where you have a word, and when you add on un in front of it, it changes the meaning. For example, or you can do it with an A as well. You have theist, a believer in God. You put an A on the front of it, and it means atheist, a non-believer. Or when it comes to, for example, follow, I'm going to follow you. You stick the un on the prefix, and all of a sudden, the meaning changes. Now I'm going to unfollow you. I'm no longer going to, head in the direction that you're going. Well, this is, in verse 27, the word new. It is the word for know, but at the beginning of it, they stick on that A to negate it. So it was that they didn't know. And one source, I think, gives the right definition for this. He says, it's a failure to know in the sense of a disobedient closing of the mind to the revealing word of God. And that's exactly what the Jews did. When Jesus came along, even if you missed the voice of the prophets, even if you couldn't take that information that you had heard and connect it with the fact that, okay, this guy was supposed to come from this place and do these things, and we've got the right idea of the Messiah, even if you couldn't connect it that way, when Jesus comes along and begins to teach in a way that nobody had ever taught, the ears should have been open. And then when Jesus comes along, he starts to cure the lepers, heal the blind, open the ears of those who can't hear. And then there are three specific cases where Jesus raised the dead. There's an implication that he raised more than that. When you have somebody doing those signs, what's screaming at you? Well, yeah, something's different, and this guy is probably from God. I mean, what Nicodemus say in John chapter 3? We know that nobody can come from God, and, you know, well, let's back it up. We know that no one can do these signs unless he's come from where? God. And we see what you're doing. And there's only one rational conclusion, and that is, I may not know exactly who you are, but I know where you've come from. And you've come from above. So from that perspective, there was really no excuse for the Jews to say, well, he's not from God and let's crucify him. Even if you couldn't figure out all the other stuff, God gave plenty of evidence that for even the simple-minded, they should have been able to understand that. But they didn't. And it's bad enough for the common person not to know it. But it would be like somebody saying, well, okay, we've got to change out a toilet. That's probably not the best illustration, but that's the first one that comes to mind. And you've got the master plumber, okay? And he says, well, I just don't know how to install the little ring around the toilet area. And you're thinking, come on, you know, how can you not know that? That is one of the simplest things. You don't really need to have any plumbing experience to figure that out. And for the Jew, if the common guy in the street couldn't get it, the rulers, the leaders, they should have known.
Sure, in that day and age, it's like this day and age, the rulers have a lot of say in thought process.
Yes.
And since he was talking to the brethren in the synagogue, these were men, assuming they were leaders of the synagogue also. So regardless of what the lower echelon thought, the thought process came from the leaders all the way down the ladder.
And this is true today. When you look at a cult, you find that the people who are involved with that, there's ignorance there in their part. And sometimes that ignorance is not so much willful, it's they were misled. When you think about our media, do you think that media can drive the beliefs of people in a nation? Look at what happened with Germany and Hitler. You know, you say these people are bad, these people are going to impact our society negatively, these people need to be destroyed, and you put that out often enough and long enough, and you saturate the message. Russia did that as well. Communism. Communism told people, you have the best life. Nobody lives as well as you do, and you pretty much choke off the media, or you only give them state-run coverage. And what are people going to believe? You're going to raise up a generation that has that mindset, and then once you convince that generation that that's good, future generations will likely have that same conclusion unless somebody finally breaks through and says, look, that is a lie, and here's the proof for it. So, and it, that can take a while to go ahead and undo. But when you think about the influence that you're talking about as far as from the top, that's a very powerful thing. So whether you're dealing with religion or you're dealing with government or something else, if people are not given the ability to think freely and critically, it's very easy to go ahead and sway the masses.
Thankfully, today we have the scriptures.
Yeah.
Which are like the brands.
Yeah.
We don't have to take everything that's said in the media or anything else.
Yeah.
Or any other religious leaders or whatever they say. If it doesn't comply with this, it doesn't comply.
Yeah. That's right. And you should have anybody, if he is trying to teach someone the truth, he would not mind to have it checked out. I mean, you have a copy of the Bible. If you don't have a copy of the Bible, I'll get you one. And you read it for yourself and see. And sometimes a person will say, well, you know, you just read a verse or two. I've had some people say that to me over the years. And I said, well, hey, I'm not asking you to. I mean, let's read the whole chapter. We can read the whole book. I mean, for the sake of time, we're not doing that. But if you think that we're taking a verse or two out of context, let's back up and read a larger chunk. So I have no objection to that whatsoever, but it was simply for the sake of time. But if you want to, as we go through these passages, each one, like I say, we can go back and look at it chapter by chapter if you like. But that's what needs to be done, and people need to understand that. Anybody else? Ray?
The words there, because they knew him not, that runs throughout the Bible. We seem to Joseph, when a new king came in there, he knew not Joseph. He'd seen when Joshua, when he came out of the conquering of the Canaanites and things, what he did, a couple of generations later, they knew not Joshua. So we see that here, they knew not who Jesus was talking about. That's a standard.
I'm glad you brought that up. When you think, let's go back to Joseph for a second. There arose the Pharaoh that knew him not. Now, do you think that Pharaoh was ignorant of Joseph? He'd never heard of this guy, Joseph, before? Not if you're in that position. Knew him not means what?
They didn't recognize
him. Or his help and his influence and what he'd done in the past. We're going to ignore you. We're going to ignore you. Not you. Not you, but Joseph. So when they say, we knew him not, that's what happened with Jesus. A lot of that was willful ignorance. Some of it they didn't get. But like I say, when you see the guy raising the dead, and you just say, let's kill him, like I think that's over in John chapter 11, after the healing of Lazarus, the Jews decided that, you know, that's willful ignorance. You are closing your eyes. That is a stubborn and rebellious heart. And that's what you have here. So a lot of different reasons for ignorance. What Don talked about is certainly true. Sometimes you have denominational problems. You have some people in religious groups. They're teaching error and leading people astray. I do want to make this additional note as well. That word, which describes knew him not, it's used in some other parts of the New Testament to describe some interesting things. Acts 17 and verse 23. It's used there to describe worship. You think there are some people who worship in ignorance? They simply don't know. Yeah. I mean, you've got the guy over here who's worshiping the rock or the mountain formation, or here's the guy that's worshiping the river or the sun, whatever that might be. So there's ignorant worship. People simply don't know. Romans 2 and verse 4. It's another passage which uses this word. And there Paul said that there were some people who were ignorant of God's goodness. Do you think today there are people that are ignorant of God's goodness? Sure. Well, they think, hey, God has been good to me. My life is really great. And if God and his goodness exist in my life, then what must be true? He's pleased with me. Do you think God is good to some people, but they're not in the right relationship with him? I mean, they go through life and they seem to breeze through life, very few problems, and they live in a free country and everything is wonderful, and they think God has blessed me. Well, he has, but not in the way that you're thinking. All right, Romans 6 and verse 3. Another passage, and Paul says, are you ignorant? Anybody remember Romans 6, first four verses, first five verses? What's the subject? Very, very good. Baptism. You think there are some people who are ignorant about baptism? Yeah, and Paul said that some people were. Some people are ignorant about what it's for. Some people are ignorant about how to do it. Some people are ignorant about what it's going to accomplish. So, ignorance there. 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 1. Another passage, Paul said that some of the Corinthians were ignorant or could be ignorant about spiritual gifts. Once again, do you think that when it comes to miraculous activities, people are ignorant? I'll give you a clue as far as where I'm headed as far as adult BBS. Somebody said, well, what are you going to do for the adult BBS? I told Stan the other night, I think I'm going to talk about the Holy Spirit. So the further I get into that, if that works, it may be more than 1 year. But anyway, just while we're on that note, if you're curious about BBS, that's free. All right, 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 11, Paul said that we can be ignorant, or the Corinthians were not ignorant of Satan's devices or techniques. Do you think some today are still ignorant about the devil? They are. So this is an important word, one more passage where it is used that I think is significant, and that's 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 and verse 13. Paul's talking about the end of time, Jesus coming back, and he says, I'd not have you ignorant about the Christians who have died, that God's going to take care of them just like he's going to take care of everybody else. And once again, a lot of people are ignorant about the end of time. All right, back to Acts chapter 13, looking at verse 28. Paul said that there was no basis in condemning Jesus, but just because there's no basis to fault someone or maybe lock someone one up in prison, does that mean that the person's not going to be locked up or condemned? No. People have been unjustly condemned. People have been unjustly put to death. And that happened with Jesus as well. Paul remembered or knew that there were repeated calls for Pilate to slay the Lord. And once again, how Paul had that information, I don't know. Maybe that was circulated so widely that he'd heard of it. Maybe he was there in Jerusalem and had come across the information that way. But he does reflect the fact that he was fully informed about the events leading up to Jesus' death. Now, here's one of the interesting things to me. Where he is, it's a reasonable distance from Jerusalem. Pilate has been out of office for about 10 years. So you've obviously got some people that have probably died since Pilate was out of office. Paul's a good distance from the area of Jerusalem. And yet he uses this in a sermon that I think suggests something about Pilate, that this fella, Pilate, he had a reputation. Sometimes you get a reputation and the reputation spreads, just like our country. You might have, anybody remember when Sarah Palin was appointed the running mate for John McCain? Okay. When that happened, was there anybody who knew who Sarah Palin was?
People of Alaska.
Well, yeah, I mean here. Anybody know who's... I can still remember Sarah Palin. Who's that? I know where Alaska is, so I hopped on Google and I thought I'm going to read up a little bit more about her. But you know, there she was, a name, I mean, still within our country, but a lot of people didn't know who she was. But now you mention Sarah Palin and what? Man, everybody knows her. And I think Pilate must have kind of fallen into the same category. You know, enough had happened in his life where even 10 years later, fair distance from Jerusalem to where Paul was, people still would have been familiar with him because of his reputation, and Paul was able to use him in this speech. All right, what happened to Jesus, especially at the end of his life, he fulfilled, key word, he fulfilled all that the Old Testament had to say about him. What would some of those Old Testament passages have involved?
Isaiah.
All right, you think about Isaiah. Jesus was going to be the one who was not going to have any bones broken. That wasn't Isaiah. But there were going to be the soldiers gambling for his clothing. He was going to be that one that was going to be put on the cross, bruised for our transgressions, and so forth. The Lord died, and they, verse 29, came and removed his body. They took him to a tomb, but the body, of course, didn't stay there. Paul, as he's preaching this, he says that Jesus' body, verse 30, was raised from the dead. Resurrection was a common theme. And then he was seen for many days by a wide variety of people. If you notice this expression, people who came up with him from Galilee to Jerusalem. Now, the force of that may not be immediately clear, but let's think about it for a second. People came up with him, Galilee to Jerusalem. What's he trying to say with those words? Yes, very good. People had been with him for a long time. So when Jesus is raised from the dead, who does he not show up to? Well, okay, I think that's one good answer. There's a second one that we can put in there. Complete strangers. He just doesn't show up on the street and say, well, hey, I'm Jesus, I'm raised from the dead. Who does he go back to? Those longtime associates or friends where they're able to look at him and say, we know what Jesus was like. We can check you out and make sure that you are the same one that was put to death on the cross. Now, as you look at Acts chapter 13 and you check out Paul's sermon, there are some other things that you want to bear in mind. For example, when you think about the apostles and you can track their lives through the book of Acts and the writings and so forth, you think about these guys, we're going to use the number 40. For roughly 40 years, they continue to serve Christ. And during that 40-year period, what do they suffer as far as persecution? They endure
beatings.
All right, they endure beatings. All right, there are imprisonments. All right, hardships of all kinds. And you have the verbal assaults. All right, and then ultimately there are some who are put to death for the faith. If this is a lie, and by this I mean the resurrection of Christ, if it didn't happen, and you're one of these apostles, for the next 40 or so years you're enduring all those things, even to the point of perhaps death, who would do that for a lie? It's not like these guys are being paid a lot of money. It's not like they were given a special position. I mean, really, they lost everything. And for just one guy to do that, you might say, well, he was just some crazy kook and write him off. But when you've got roughly a dozen guys spending four decades, really their entire lives, their entire adult lives, proclaiming this message, going around and being chased from place to place, it makes no sense unless Jesus really was raised from the dead. And then you begin to find that these guys were preaching the same message. I'm not going to give you all the references. If you want them, I can get them to you. But when you go back and you look at Acts 2, that's where Peter was preaching, and you compare that with Acts chapter 13, where Paul's preaching, you find the exact same message. You find that Peter, he says that Jesus had been killed by people. Paul says the same thing. Peter says that Jesus was raised from the dead. Well, Paul makes that same point here in Acts 13. Peter goes back and offers a citation from Psalm 16. Paul did that too. Peter said that David did not return from the dead. Paul said Same point. Peter said God raised up the Messiah from the seed of David. Paul also points that out. Jesus' body did not see corruption. Acts 2:31, Paul said that as well. Acts 13:37. All right, that takes care of all that information that I had. Anything that you want to look at before we look at verse 32 in Acts 13? Stan?
I find it interesting in verse 28, and maybe it's just that it's one of those statements that you just read over and don't really give it any thought, but it, to me it adds impact to the whole idea that Jesus was put to death. It says, yet they desired Pilate that he should be slain. Pilate himself drew the conclusion, there's nothing wrong because there's no reason why Jesus should be put to death. You can maybe get wrapped up in all that they were doing and all the people that were involved. But in that same verse it says, and though they found no cause of death in him, they knew he wasn't guilty of anything. They knew they were putting an innocent man to death. Just seems so blatant what they were doing.
Well, when people want to do something, it's like somebody who wants to buy something. You may not have a good reason. And especially husband-wife relationship. Well, why do you want that? And you can give a dozen different reasons. None of them make sense. But if that's what you want, chances are you might be able to push that far enough to finally get what you want. And you might explain it somehow, but still, it doesn't make sense. And that's really what they did with Jesus. They wanted him dead, especially going back to Don's point. It was the leadership that was really pushing for that. They couldn't explain it away. They had sent different delegations, if you will, to try and trap him in different ways, and everything failed. And finally, it was, okay, let's just put our head on the platter as far as the guillotine, and we're just going to take the hit for it because it's better for us to kill an innocent man rather than let this continue. It's just got to be stopped. And when you look at Pilate, there were multiple attempts by Pilate. It wasn't just once. I mean, he didn't just get that and say, I'm going to wash my hands and I'm done. But he tried different things to get out of calling for Jesus' condemnation or authorizing it. That's probably a better way to describe it. And the crowd simply would not let him go. And finally, he caved in. Tim?
He did cave in, but he had the power not to cave in.
Yes.
He was a man of weak character. You know, he wanted this position, and he didn't want, he knew that if he didn't go along with them, they could possibly go to Caesar and make enough trouble for him where he would be removed from his job. So he didn't want that, and that was because he just had a weak character.
A lot of people think that a position of power is attractive and fun. Well, there are certainly some benefits to it, but at the same time, if you ever get that kind of job, it's not all benefits and fun. Chances are you're going to be hit from two different sides, at least a few times, sometimes several sides. And those two different sides have competing interests that are usually at odds with one another. And there are some people who try to play both sides, but then there are some other people that you really have to respect them regardless if you agree with the, you know, what their position is. And politicians would fall into that category. Well, they will actually stand up and say, look, I believe in these principles or these are my values, and I'm saying no to you because I believe it's wrong. But if you're in that position and you're being squeezed from both sides, it is not a pleasant side to be in. And Pilate was. And he was someone who, as you rightly mentioned, had that weak character, and he did cave.
Well, he knew.
Yeah.
Everybody knew that everything that was said about Jesus was always about the good that he did. There was no bad that he did, so nobody could say anything about it. About bad things that he did because he didn't do anything bad. And yet Pilate knew, he told the Jews, he said, I'm going to release unto you Barabbas because he's guilty of sedition and murder. He knew this guy was, if anybody deserved capital punishment, he did.
Yeah.
And he knew Jesus didn't. But he, because of his character, he let it go the way it did. And because of their character and their leadership that wanted to keep their jobs with their phylacteries and all the pomp and circumstance, they were willing to kill an innocent person so they could keep all that.
Yeah. Herod, or Pilate was a slippery guy. Remember that when he hears that Jesus was a Galilean, oh, let's send him up to Herod. We'll try to go ahead and pass the buck off to him. Well, Herod was glad to see Jesus, but Herod sends him back because, once again, he was not really interested in dealing with that. So, but yeah, you're exactly correct, Don.
Well, to Dan and Jim's points, I guess, my mind, I have a hard time. If I were a leader in the temple and I was demanding that Jesus be put to death, and I knew that he was the Son of God, or I thought he was the Son of God, and I believed in God, then you could go ahead and crucify somebody that you thought might be the Son of God. That's a pretty slippery slope for people that are leaders in the temple.
Yeah, it was. But I suspect, Don, what they were thinking was nobody had ever been, at least in their lifetime, anything like this. I don't think they thought anybody would, in their lifetime, ever be like that again. So this is one, it's kind of a one-time problem. Let's see if we can find, while we're looking with that, Caiaphas. I was thinking John 11 or Luke 7. Those may not be the right passages. But Caiaphas talked about better to do this and preserve the nation because he's just one man. Luke.
Did he believe that Jesus was the Son of God?
I'm sorry?
Did he believe that Jesus was the Son of God?
Well, if they did, I'm not sure how they would have defined Son of God, Don.
John 11:48.
Is it 11:48? Do you want to read it?
I can read it. I don't know if it's...
Okay, we'll try it.
Actually, 49.
Okay.
But a certain one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all."
Very good, Lois. Let's read 52.
52?
No, the next verse. Oh, 50. 50 as well. I'm sorry, I didn't explain that well.
Okay. Nor do you take into account that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation should not perish.
Thank you so much. That was exactly it. We could go down to 51 as well.
Okay. Now this he did not say on his own initiative, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus was going to die for the nation.
Okay. So Don, in part, I think that would suggest maybe a little bit of an answer for your question, that he quite didn't understand. Again, you're back to the ignorance here. He quite didn't get it. Had they really understood that Jesus was the Son of God, had they really gotten what we understand that to mean, I think they probably would have rethought that. But Caiaphas' opinion seems to be, look, you know, we've got this situation, we've tried to contain it, everything that we have done has failed, he's leading everybody astray. We don't quite know exactly who he is. We certainly don't know what to do with him except put him to death. So it's kind of like one of those cases where you have two choices. You really hate both choices. But if you don't do something, that's not really an option. So you've got to choose. And they say, I think of them as 49-51 decisions. I don't like those decisions. But I've either got to take one or the other. So I'm going to say this one is 51%. This one is 49%. And even though there's a two-point spread there, that's going to be the deciding factor. I'm going to get stuck whichever way I go.
So Caiaphas is saying that he didn't really believe that Jesus was the Son of God, but in his expediency to the nation that he had died.
Yeah, I'm not sure in the first part. Like I say, I don't know exactly how they would have defined Son of God. I mean, we know how the Bible defines it. But
that's what Paul's telling
them. Yeah, but if you're a Jew and you have all these passages trying to put your head around God taking on the form of human flesh. I mean, they'd seen the theophanies, for example, with Moses and all the Old Testament quote-unquote appearances of God. But Jesus brought things to a whole new level. And until somebody actually came forward and explained that, because Jesus hints at that in a lot of different ways. For example, I'm the living bread that's come down to heaven. I'm the living water and so forth. So he sort of dances around that a little bit, because you can imagine the reaction of the Jews. If you would have said, I'm deity in the flesh, well, they already had some people who called him crazy. And if you run around making that kind of claim, they're going to think that you're really insane. So, you know, he takes them, I think, as far as they can go. They weren't willing to go that far. And they call for his death. But had they really understood who he was, I think they would have said, well, we're just going to reject him. But even that would have been problematic. Stan, we'll pick up your thought for now.
Well, the
there are multiple things going on here. We're looking at it from just one standpoint, but the Jews at that time were having a real issue from a secular standpoint also. And they had, Jesus is not the first one to come along and gather people behind him in a movement. And consequently, they were looking at it from a standpoint of, if we let this man go, he's going to stir up the Romans and we're going to be in deep trouble. And like you say, he was not the first one that had come along who had tried that, and he wasn't the last as far as that goes.
Right.
But then on the other hand, he's also speaking to them from a religious standpoint, and that was difficult for them to understand. And then from the third standpoint, he was going to ruin their jobs. So they had a multitude of things that they were dealing with here. And so if you can put yourself in the place of the Jews at that particular time, I myself believe there was a lot more turmoil, a lot more personal turmoil as well as community turmoil over the fact that Jesus existed. And therefore, that made it really difficult for the majority of them to focus and to think about really what Jesus was saying and who he was.
Yeah, I agree. On those points were really, really fine. I'm glad that you brought them up. Because there had been the false Christ that showed up. Jesus said, Matthew chapter 24, more were going to appear as well. And if you're a leader, that's obviously something that's always going to be on your radar screen because you don't want people to be led astray. I was thinking, too, as you're talking about that, Acts 3 and verse 17, this goes back to Peter much earlier in the book of Acts. But Peter says, and now, brethren, I know that in ignorance she did it, as also did your rulers. So God was clear. Had they not been completely ignorant, that would have been one thing. But you do have that willful ignorance. You also have all the things that you and Don talked about. And all those forces are kind of competing and coming together. And you've got worries from the Romans. You've got worries from false Christ. You've got worries about, you know, this Jesus. He's in a completely different category. You've got worries about the job. You know, we know that God has given the temple. What's going to happen to the temple? And you've got to almost feel like your head is swimming after a period of time. And God does recognize that. So they were not going to get off scot-free. But God at least was able to say, I can have some appreciation for where you're coming from, and I'm not going to strike you dead. I am going to give you some chances to repent. And in fact, he said the gospel had to go to the Jews first, which was, when you consider what he did, very, very gracious. That it? Betty, sorry.
You wouldn't accept that he was Christ, but then you fulfill prophets.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't accept him, but yet you did what the scripture said you were going to do.
Yeah, and that's really a great point, because you have God sort of trying a two-step process here. For example, almost a three-step process. You prophesy, send him in the world, they reject what they had heard and learned. Jesus shows all of his stuff. They reject that. And then Paul and some other preachers are able to come along as far as the third swipe and say, all that stuff that happened, they're reaching back into history. Remember the promises of the Father, all this stuff. And this was God's plan, and you rejected it. And he fills in all the blanks. Now, that's going to create one of two reactions. Either you're going to have a good heart, and you're going to be able to see all that stuff. And after all the dots are connected, you say, I'm a person who has a good heart. That's right. I'm sorry. I'm going to become a Christian. Or you become a rebellious Jew and say no. And we're going to see certainly that latter reaction here in Acts chapter 13. Okay, with about 4 minutes left, let's see how far we can get with verse 32. I think we can finish that one out as well. And he says, he continues, we bring you good tidings of the promise made unto the fathers. Christianity is a message of good news or good tidings. We think about man. He was created by God. We know that man decided not to obey God's will. That rebellion took place in the garden and it's continued. And man can't save himself. So God intervened ultimately by sending Jesus. And now that salvation is possible to all people. Paul talks about that salvation. He says it goes all the way back to the fathers. You can even see it, I think, as far as Adam and Eve. But with the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, think for a minute about Abraham. Remember back there in Genesis chapter 12, Genesis 12, 1 through 3, God said, look, I'm going to make a great nation of you, and you're going to have all kinds of descendants. You can't begin to imagine how many descendants you're going to have. Well, God repeated that chapter, or God repeated that promise three chapters later in Genesis chapter 15. And then he repeats that chapter three chapters later in Genesis chapter 18, Genesis chapter 18 and verse 18. The Jews would have been familiar with what God had promised to Abraham, and Paul reaches back to this and says, hey, remember Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, remember way back there, God has fulfilled those promises. Now, if you're a Jew, familiar with the promises, and somebody comes along and says, God has fulfilled those promises, what do you think your first question is going to be?
When was that?
When was that? Who was that?
Where?
How was that? Where was that? Why was that? And Paul's able to deal with those questions as other Christians did. Now, here's another little point that's kind of interesting. In verse 33, you're going to see the... Let's make that... Double check that. Yeah, in verse 33, you're going to see that word fulfilled again. Now, that's important because that term may seem to be identical to the word fulfilled back there in verse 27. But it's not. There's a slight difference. That word, which we're not going to get to today, it describes a complete fulfillment. For example, if somebody says, I'm full, can that mean different things? Go to lunch and somebody says, I'm full. Ever had somebody at lunch and the person says, okay, Gary?
Well, and this happens a lot with Reed sometimes. He says, I'm full, but really it just means I don't want any more of this.
Yes. Kids are a good example of that. Or you say after you've had a meal, I'm full. Oh, they have the tastiest dessert, and you shove a picture over for somebody to take a look at. And boy, the eyes just start to water, and well, I'm not quite that full. Okay, so they have the dessert, right? But then you have another case where the person says, I'm full, and you say, this is the most wonderful dessert. Don't come here very often. They're going to close. And what's the person say? I can't eat another bite. So when you think about full in those terms, you have a good illustration for what's going on here. When you look at the word, which we're not going to get to today in verse 33, it describes completely full. There is nothing left to fulfill. Now think about that word in terms of who Paul is talking to, these Jews. When he says, the promises to Abraham, they've been fulfilled. How fully, Paul? All the way. Now once again, if you're thinking in terms of a Jew, you're thinking, who did that? When was that done? How was that done? Where was that done? Tell me the answer to these questions. And Paul says the answer is who? Jesus Christ, who was killed by Jews in Jerusalem while Pilate was in control. And they're thinking, wow.